The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
My next guest has a kind of an extraordinary story to tell, and actually I think any parent should listen to this story. And actually, if you have a teenager somewhere in the house or somewhere in the environs, I would say bring them in and get them to listen to this. Hilda Hamilton, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
Hilda, before we get down to that, congratulations to yourself. You also set a land speed record of a sort. So the unofficial fastest woman cycling from Mizzen to Mallon. When did you do this?
The 19th of June. So just under a month ago.
Okay, and how quickly did you do it, or how long was it?
And we did it in 23 hours and 11 seconds.
Remarkable. Is it all in one go, or how does it work?
Yeah, all in one go. We had 5 stops in total. We stopped for 10 minutes at a time just to change our clothes if we're going into the night cycle, or to refuel. So non-stop.
Well done. And like, I presume that's not just something you decide to get up on your bike and you'll do it some morning. There was a lot of prep and science and everything involved, is there?
Absolutely. A huge amount of preparation went into it. It was a plan that came up over COVID at Christmas time. My friend from my cycle club, James Forbes, asked me would I be interested in doing it. And I remember at the time when he said it, I thought it was absolutely ridiculous. It's 600 kilometres, and before that I'd only ever done maybe 100, 150. So it just seemed so inconceivable. We got in touch with Joe Barr, who holds the record from going Mallon to Mizzen and back non-stop in like 43 hours or something. So he guided us through the whole process, and his wife is a high performance nutritionist, so we worked very closely with her. And
I presume the food and everything and taking fuel on board and all that is quite complicated. And listen, you did it for Cycle Against Suicide, and there's a reason for that. Maybe if we go back to the beginning, I suppose, and in terms of, you had a good upbringing, you would say yourself, quite a privileged upbringing.
Yeah, correct. I grew up in Sandy Cove, played tennis, went swimming in 40 foot, went to a local school, Rathdown, had a great time there. Played hockey, represented Leinster, played netball for Ireland, had great pals. Privileged, happy childhood.
And it strikes me then, you weren't the kind of kid that your parents would have thought they would have had to worry about or anything. You were sporty, outgoing, all that kind of stuff, healthy.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. Okay. And then, went to UCD, did an arts degree on a hockey scholarship.
Yeah.
And then it was a kind of after you did the arts degree then you were kind of unsure about what to do with yourself and stuff.
I think I absolutely love college. It was my favorite time. Great friends, great sporting opportunities, and just was at my element in college. And then I guess afterwards, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I didn't have like a very clear purpose of wanting to be a doctor or an accountant. So I decided to do ski season. So I tried that, and then I came back from that, and one of our pals died by suicide, and it kind of threw us a little bit, and we felt like, you know, in hindsight, we'd no idea. He was very outgoing as well, and he had everything to live for. So then myself...
So you came home?
I came home from the ski season, attended that funeral, went back out then again, and then came home again, and still was a little bit unclear of where I wanted to go. So my friends and I, it was summertime, we said, let's go to Asia and do that for a while, and I suppose kick the bucket down the road slightly. And then while we were travelling around Vietnam, my best pal sister drowned. So we had to then travel back from the island, get a train home, fly from Saigon, and eventually get back to Dublin. So in hindsight, there was a lot of trauma going on, and yeah. I suppose we were quite young and didn't really know how to process the emotions that we were feeling at the time.
And I presume as well, like, you got home, you were kind of tired, run down.
Absolutely.
You'd been partying
sleep
and stuff.
Deprived, and, yeah, partying too much, out late, going to the moon festivals, like swimming, and really pushing our bodies.
But all that stuff that tens of thousands of kids have done down the years. But then kind of, I suppose, something different happened for you then. So you went to a party, and bearing in mind all that frame of mind and what was going on with you and everything, went to a party, took a knee.
Correct.
What happened?
I developed drug-induced psychosis from the ecstasy.
How did that, like, what does that mean? How did it manifest?
It started firstly at the party, getting really paranoid, and then thinking, like, I remember listening to a tape in my room, "Give Up Your Old Sins," and thinking I was getting messages from it. Just feeling really agitated.
So you had gone home, had you?
Yeah, I was living at home at the time.
Okay.
Everything was heightened. Like, my senses were heightened. I just was having completely illogical thought process, thinking my mum was being chased down by George Bush. You know, you can laugh about it now, but in the moment, it's quite frightening.
Yeah, and like, you had no experience with kind of mental health issues before this or anything, so you didn't know what was going on.
No.
And then, so this was all night at home then, yeah?
Yeah, it didn't just stop, unfortunately. Then it continued, and I remember my father's on a phone. I remember thinking at the time that he was in cahoots trying to organise to get me to kill my mum or something, and I jumped out the window of my bedroom. Looking back now as a parent myself, I can only imagine how hard that was for my dad.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and look, I know this is something that you haven't spoken about much, and you have not spoken about in public and stuff, so I know this is probably difficult, but I know at the same time that you really want to do this.
Yeah, no, I really do, and I think it's so important that we destigmatise the shame and destigmatise a mental illness. So I'm very much happy to speak about it.
Yeah, so do you remember why you decided to jump out the window? Like, what? I know the thought process wasn't logical, but do you remember what it was like?
Like, when I look back, that is something I think about a great deal. And I wonder, in my head, when I was having these illogical thoughts, to be honest, I have no idea. I wasn't thinking, I was completely scrambled, Brandon. I have no idea what my thought process was leading up to that.
Where were your parents?
At the time.
Yeah.
In the house.
Okay.
Trying to get me help.
Okay. So they were there and they suddenly noticed you jumped out the window.
Hmm.
Yeah. Okay. What happened then?
I got rushed to Vincent's, and I was admitted to the psychiatric ward in Vincent's. And I suppose then they were kind of started, I'm sure it was a relief for my mum and dad to know I was safe.
Yeah.
And I suppose then we started just trying to unscramble what had happened with, like, at the time I was on 24-hour watch, and
For suicide?
I don't think for suicide. I think for psychotic episodes.
Okay.
As in,
and had your mental health, like,
it was,
had it resolved itself at this stage? Did you count? No, you were still, like, going in and out of psychosis.
Yeah.
And your parents, like, this is their perfect daughter. And hockey star, and yeah.
I know. And,
and both your legs were broken as well.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay. So then a lot of rehab and a lot of...
A lot of rehab. I think the first step in this whole process was to make sure I was safe and I couldn't do damage to myself or others in my psychotic state. And then the second stage was it was drug-induced psychosis. So it was obviously a chemical imbalance that had taken place in my brain. So the psychiatric doctors were trying to rectify that. So give me antipsychotic meds to get me down from that extreme high, I guess.
Had you taken ecstasy before?
I had.
Okay. So what do you think was different this time?
I think it was laced with something, you know.
Yeah.
I suppose whenever you take illegal drugs, it's like Russian roulette, isn't it?
And and like when you're young, you don't think about it that way, and you think of where these things come from and the people you're getting them off and everything.
Exactly.
Like,
100%.
Yeah. So. So how long were you in hospital then?
2 weeks, 2-3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, so when you came out then, like if someone had met you then, so you were this kind of outgoing, sporty, you know, obviously social person, everything. What kind of person were you then?
I was completely numb. I was in a wheelchair, so physically I looked a bit different. I was broken, I guess, like... I was very introvert. I probably wouldn't have been much. I wouldn't have been much. I wouldn't have had much conversation to say. It's quite quiet.
And that would have been the opposite of what you were before.
Absolutely.
So broken physically and then emotionally.
Mentally, just really. Yeah. I suppose in order to get the balance right, they had to bring me right down, and then.
Okay. Okay, so the drugs were having an effect on that as well. And you would say you were suicidal at times?
At that stage, no. At that stage, I was just
empty.
Exactly, exactly. I think that was nearly not even the hardest part. It was the next part of the whole
journey.
Tell
me about the next part.
So I think that part, I had a very clear plan. I was going to, you know, hopefully learn to walk again. The prognosis, the doctor said I'd struggle to walk again. And I think that really set me back because I was so active before. So I was quite determined to kind of get back walking. And my parents were amazing, really supportive. I remember wheeling down the road and asking Dad to push me, and he was determined I'd build up. But he was like, push yourself, come on. Which was great. So I kind of had a little goal in place that helped me. And so I kept going at that. And I suppose in my head, as I'm talking to my aunt about this, I had hoped that once I got out of the wheelchair, I'd be back to the way I was. And I suppose then when I did start walking again, it wasn't. And I think then the depression and the suicidal thoughts started kicking in. I felt really lost. I felt such shame at what I'd done. I felt so, such a burden on my family and my friends. Like, I had some amazing friends that would call over, bring me for a walk, bring me down the pier. And I was just so vacant. I didn't really feel I was contributing anything to the friendships. So I enrolled in a postgraduate course. I couldn't even stand up and say my name. It was a really, really hard time because it's, I suppose, reality and perception is so key in striving. And my reality was one thing and my perception on the reality was so skewed.
Okay.
I felt I was a complete fly in the ointment in my family life and with my friends as well. So I think that for me was the hardest part.
Okay. And then I think, what a lot of people get lucky the first time that they find a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist or whatever, and they find the right person. Yeah. And then some people are unlucky. And like, without getting into any details or names of the person or anything, you were unlucky the first time.
I was unlucky. You know, he's a remarkable psychiatrist, but unfortunately we just didn't click. And I suppose that's really important if anyone, any of your listeners are struggling to find someone, and be ruthless. Make sure you find the right match, because it's not going to work otherwise.
He actually kind of, in a way, told you to cop yourself on,
Yeah.
That, what did he say to you?
I think it was the first time I'd really put, like, I genuinely thought at the time, because I was so low, that life would be better without me. So I expressed that I didn't want to be here anymore. And he told me that, you know, I was very lucky. I came from a privileged background. I had so much to be grateful for. And then he's like, okay,
get
goodbye.
A grip, like, yeah.
And I suppose, you know, when you're really struggling and you open to someone and they dismiss you like that, it just adds the shame and your self-worth. You're like, if, you know, I'm paying a man to give me guidance here and he's telling me that I should be grateful for, then it kind of makes you feel more, more shame, more worthless.
Yeah.
And maybe you're right in your thought process.
And then you did get lucky and you met the right person. And I think this is, it's very important what your journey to healing was. And I suppose it's still the way you live your life.
100%.
And it's very much around kind of physically looking after yourself as well. Yeah. Just tell us about your regime now.
My regime. Well, I think there's such a link between physical exercise and mental health. And I think, you know, the studies show serotonin, endorphins are released when you're moving. It doesn't have to be intense, or when you're swimming in the sea. I'm really mindful of getting the right sleep, trying my best to eat nutritious food, and moving and exercise. And then the fourth thing I always look out for is who I'm associating with.
Okay.
The five people you see the most, you become. So I'm really mindful about that.
Okay, so the five people you see the most, you become. That's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah.
Hilda, the thing is, right, I think it's easy these days, in a way, for a lot of people who are maybe in the public eye or have particular kinds of jobs, to come out and talk about their mental health. And I think a lot of the time, it's kind of, you know, it's anxiety and a bit of depression and stuff. This is the real messy end of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's something, as you say, there's a lot of levels of shame and stigma around all of that.
Mm.
And you're not somebody in the public eye, like, you're a businesswoman, you're a mom to three small kids and everything. And in a way, you have a lot to lose by talking about this publicly. And I presume, in a way, this now is also you coming out to a lot of other people who mightn't know you well, but who kind of know you and everything. But you feel that it could be helpful for I think teenage girls in particular.
100%, 100%. Like, it's so tough nowadays. Like, when I was in my teens, I didn't struggle with mental health, but one in three girls especially will experience mental health difficulties. Like, the stats are staggering, Brendan. Like, we have to destigmatize it and we have to talk. The CEO is telling me that we're the fourth highest in the world for the suicide rate for 15 to 29 year olds. Like, you know, we really do. And I hope that by me sharing my story, that even one person might go, God, you know, my learning in the whole thing is just get support and ask for help. And if you can do that, you can get through really hard things. And it was very indicative of the training I did for Malintimism. And, you know, we were only as good as the team. And we had to, the minute we struggled on that race, we had to put our hands up and say, guys, we need to slow it down. Or I can't keep the speed up, or I need to fuel. Or if someone's going quiet, you go, what's going on? Talk to me. And that's how we got over the finishing line in that speed, because we were able to express vulnerability. And I think that's the same when you're a teenage girl, if you have a good inner narrative, you can overcome really hard things. Because it is hard for them out there trying to navigate through social media and everything.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's harder now probably than it was for you back then.
So do I. I think it's going to be like cigarettes. They're going to look back on social media and go, how did we not see this?
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think a lot of people who held out until the pandemic possibly, we loosened up a bit because it was all they had and everything. But yeah,
100%.
I think it's really got a super grip now. Listen, Hilda, I know that can't have been easy, but I do think it was very valuable and very brave of you to do so. And look, I hope you get a good reaction to it, and I hope you don't regret doing that. But God, it's some story. Thank you very much, Hilda Hamilton, and lots and lots of supportive texts, by the way, so you can feel good about that. And there are other people here saying similar stories, not mental health, but somebody who same thing happened to my child, spent months in hospital, but thanks to family, friends and hospital, living a normal life now. Another person here lost our eldest son to suicide, but the root cause was drug induced psychosis. I'm baffled why drug control is not a bigger political issue. Our country is ravaged with it. For the life of me, I've no idea what national strategy is. And just one more, Hilda. That woman should be so proud of herself for speaking out. She's amazing. Lots of young people don't recognise the correlation between recreational drugs and mental health. Well done. Well done, Hilda Hamilton. Let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.